Hello and welcome to the Global Film Podcast, a weekly discussion of all things cinema. I'm your host, Diego Andaluz, and today I'm happy to be joined by Ahmed, Editor-in-Chief of Film Updates.
Hi everyone, great to be here.
John Negroni, Editor-in-Chief of Cinemaholics, critic for Awards Watch, The Young Folks, and The Spool, and host of the Cinemaholics podcast.
Hey, how's it going?
And David Cuevas, Festival Editor for Film Hounds Magazine.
Hello.
On today's episode, we are discussing Jay Blakeson's latest Netflix release, I Care A Lot, and A24's latest Sundance hit and awards contender, directed by Lee Isaac Chung, Minari. Well, let's delve right into I Care A Lot, which tells a story of a shady legal guardian who lands in hot water when she tries to bilk a woman who has ties to a powerful gangster. So Ahmad, so you've been pretty much raving about this film, if I'm correct, ever since it kind of started getting some buzz. So what are your thoughts on this one?
Well, personally, the movie floored me, I have to say. I was not expecting the movie that we ended up getting. I think it says so much about our current state of social, political affairs, and it's just filled to the brim with social commentary. I don't think it works on a surface level just because there's no clear protagonist to root for. So some audiences will struggle with that. But I feel like if you read between the lines and just really pay attention to what director Jay Blakeson is trying to say, it's just a knockout of a movie. I will say I don't think it would have worked if it were anyone other than Rosamund Pike in this role, because she really knocks it out of the park. And I also think that this could have had a real shot at a Best Original Screenplay nomination if it was campaigned for correctly, because it is, you know, I just thought the script was amazing. It reminded me a lot of Nightcrawler. There have been so many Gone Girl comparisons for obvious reasons, but to me, it's Nightcrawler. You know, both really difficult movies to swallow. And that ending, you know, just the perfect ending. I was really anxious to see how they'd wrap it up. But honestly, I could not see another ending that would work for this. It really was, I think, the defining statement of what director and writer Jay Blakeson was trying to say. And so just, you know, the cherry on top of a great movie.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what Ahmed said about how the film actually plays with social commentary and almost genre conventions in such a clever way. It's been a little while since I first saw I Care A Lot, which was back at the Toronto International Film Festival. And something about it has really stuck with me, performance-wise and even filmmaking-wise, but also just as what was previously mentioned, the script. The script is rapid, paced, fun, vibrant, but also makes you think. It's a very provoking script and ends on almost a purposefully anticlimactic note that leaves the audience with something to think about. There's something about that final shot involving Macon Blair and Rosamund Pike that really hits home the message on greed and how kind of like these cycles of violence and perpetration end up hitting one back at the end of the day. So yeah, it's a really, really strong film in my opinion.
Yeah, I think we're gonna find a lot of agreement here. I think it sounds like we all definitely like this one to some extent. I certainly am I'm a bit more fresh on it. I didn't see this at TIFF, but I did watch it this past week, and I was a little anxious to see it because I felt like Rosamund Pike's career has been not the strongest in the last few years since Gone Girl. I think she's been around for quite a while. She was a Bond girl for, I think it was Die Another Day. And, you know, she's a tremendously talented actress, but it has just felt like some of her more recent work has sort of pigeonholed her into this part of her career that doesn't realize her greatest strengths. I actually feel kind of the same way for Jay Blakeson, the director, who I had no expectations for this because I was like, oh, Jay Blakeson, you know, he did The Fifth Wave and he was a screenwriter for, I think, the second Descent. And he's never really like a director that has been at like the top of my must watch list. Although I think The Disappearance of Alice Creed is a pretty solid film. And I think going into this, hearing that it was getting some praise, particularly for Pike's performance, definitely piqued my interest. And, you know, it's easy to see why she is iconic in this film. I think this film recognizes her strengths in ways that, for example, Radioactive just clearly didn't. And I think the reason is because I disagree a little bit with Ahmad. I think you said that there's no protagonist in this film. And I think that's not the case. I think she is the protagonist in the same way that in Nightcrawler, Jake Gyllenhaal's character is the protagonist. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're a good person. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you always feel at peace about rooting for them. But I do think a lot of people are going to watch this and they are going to, as this movie begins on a note of feeling horrified by this woman, who is a clear, it's a horror story of a sort of thing where you're following the villain in anybody else's story. But I think it's intriguing to follow her part of the story and what it's like when she is the protagonist. And like has been mentioned, I think the script definitely handles the way that you root for somebody that you don't really want to root for without losing interest. I think Miles will vary and people will watch this and there will be many discussions about how well or not well this film handles that, but I think it's saved by introducing this element of Peter Dinklage and twisting the story on its head. I think the entire cast here is extremely strong, with Isaac Gonzalez, who has a great supporting turn here as Marla's accomplice and love interest, and then also Peter Dinklage as the mob boss and Chris Messina as the fast-talking lawyer. And not enough good things could be said about Diane Wiest, who is just being totally utilized here as this film's secret weapon. I think this film just completely works and is an easy recommend to anybody who has been craving this kind of like original dark comedy that we don't get often enough, I think.
Yeah, so I saw this one back at TIFF, like David, actually before Netflix even was considering to pick it up. And it was surprising because I thought it was maybe okay, especially like you were saying, Jay Blakeson, he's had his hits, he's had his misses, so I didn't really know what to expect. And same with Rosamund Pike. I feel most people going into this film had their fair share of hits and misses lately, so I wasn't quite sure what to expect, but it did seem like something that I would enjoy, so that's why I decided to put it on and review it, which I actually reviewed it for Awards Watch all the way back at TIFF, and it did surprise me quite a lot. In a good way. I mean, honestly, I'd say this film actually reminded me a lot of Bad Education as well, specifically its screenplay, in terms of that it takes a story that out of context or is much more serious than how it's portrayed, but this is able to bring not necessarily a comedic angle, but a much more like engaging, breezy angle to it that makes it refreshing instead of like your standard crime drama or something that just we've seen a lot of lately. But this is able to kind of bring a refreshing palate cleanser to especially the Netflix catalog as of late. And I feel that what it's able to do here is also, which, well, we'll get into the ending in a little bit. I think we're going to have a little spoiler section at the end or towards the latter half of this discussion. But the ending also, I feel like that also helps recontextualize it into a little bit of a darker tale. But overall, I feel the performances were great. The cinematography was great. Again, I think the script was definitely the highlight of the entire film. I mean, that script, again, very reminiscent of Bad Education, which is actually up for quite a couple of awards. I think USC Scripter being one of them. I do agree that I feel that if this film had been campaigned better, it could have definitely slid into the comedy section. I mean, I believe Rosamund Pike got a nomination on the Golden Globes, but that was more for her star power rather than the actual quality of the film. And I feel it definitely could have gone further if campaigned correctly. And overall, Rosamund Pike's performance, I think I may have to disagree a little bit with some of you guys here. I don't think it quite reaches the heights of Gone Girl. It's definitely in that vein, but it takes a more, a more lighter, more comedic twist to kind of the role she plays in Gone Girl. But I do have to say that it's much better than Radioactive or anything else that she's done as of late.
I really love the comparison about Bad Education. I think both Bad Education and I Care a Lot have a lot of similar territory, whereas Bad Education is based on a true story, and it is basically a chronicle of the screenwriter's own personal experiences of attending that high school. I Care a Lot is a completely fictional film, and I think that even with the fictional narrative, both have a lot going for in terms of social commentary and how they depict basically a group of corrupt people exploiting the needs of a certain population. In the case of Bad Education, it's the youth community in the high school in which they're basically stealing funding sources from them. In I Care a Lot, it's the elderly community and population in which the group played by Rosamund Pike and Isaac Gonzalez exploits them for financial gain post-mortem. I think both are very witty very smart, extremely fast-paced. And I would also like to mention that the music in the film also amplifies a lot of the action and tension. A lot of I Care a Lot isn't very action-based, if we're talking specifically about kind of like traditional sort of crime flick, quote-unquote. But what makes it so compelling is sort of the pace of the dialogue, the pace of the montages, and that's amplified by the music and the score that's with the images on display. So I think it's a very impressive film on a directional level. And as all of you have already previously said, the script is indeed very smart, very sharp, and very vibrant in all the right ways.
I definitely want to say something about the Bad Education comparison. I do think this is like a notch above that, in my opinion, just because I think while I was watching this, I was actually thinking, man, I hope they don't have this sort of like extra noble, you know, journalist character that they feel needs to be put in here so the audience can have a surrogate. I like that this film has the boldness to just allow Rosamund Pike's character to be at the forefront and for them to really dig into what she does. I mean, I think the big difference there between that and also Nightcrawler is that you really see behind the veil of this scheme, and it's all leading toward the social commentary I think has been remarked on, which is about like who wins in this country. You know, what do you actually have to do to find success in a country where the people who own everything are the ones who win out? And I think it's a deft story about that. And I think the ruthlessness on display doesn't need, you know, a character to be this like noble character coming in to try to cheat the system, because reality isn't always like that. And so that's just something I personally preferred. And I'll also agree with Diego. I don't think her performance is quite as good as it is in Gone Girl. I think I haven't really decided one way or the other, but they're certainly comparable, which is enough to celebrate, I think.
Yeah, I definitely agree with everything you guys were saying, but I just wanted to touch upon John saying that the character is a protagonist. I can definitely agree with that. Personally, for me, she was a bit hard to root for, because some of the scenes with that involved the elderly towards the beginning of the movie were hard to stomach for me personally, because of my grandmother's struggles a lot, because she's old in age. So that was hard for me to really stomach some of those scenes, specifically in the beginning. So that was where I was kind of, you know, having reservations when it came to her status as a protagonist. But yeah, she definitely is, you know, the protagonist of the movie. But I think they walked a very fine line between making her, you know, someone that the audience can not necessarily root for, but empathize with in the long run, and then making her someone who was totally irredeemable. And I think when we discuss the ending, I think we'll probably touch on that a bit more as well.
One of the things that I really appreciated about the script was that, apart from its breezy pace, kind of a little bit off what Ahmed was saying, was that it's able to definitely impress with like this tonal balancing act, that it like there's some things that are cruel, but at the same time, you're able to feel empathetic for Rosamund Pike's character, regardless of whether or not you're actually rooting for her. The fact that you can actually like you can see her point of view, and it's not presented like from a villain's point of view, and it does so successfully without maybe seeming a little bit controversial or a little bit too cruel, I feel is something that the script needs to be commended for. Because a lot of these films, again, we've seen even like with Joker, with Cruella, that when they take that approach, they either have to go all in through the villain's perspective or all through like, oh, this saint's perspective. And this film traverses that moral gray line, I think, in a very, very compelling way. And so I think that was also something that really attracted me in terms of how great the script is just able to balance all these tones. And again, I feel that we really can't have much more of a discussion without bringing in the consequences of the ending, because that, again, as mentioned prior, that really brings the story full circle. And I think the themes and the commentary it's trying to achieve as well, that final ending where kind of everything comes crashing down. And I mean, we'll discuss it in a bit, but everything comes crashing down around her, and eventually she comes crashing down as well, I feel does add yet another angle to this film. So I guess whoever wants to start up with this, again, we can discuss just the entire film, but now we can bring in any spoilers from beginning to end.
So one thing that my friends and I have been comparing about the ending is that the ending to I Care a Lot is very eerily similar to the ending of Uncut Gems. And just like what John said, both deal with the legacy of the American dream, the tangibility of the American dream, and who truly runs this country. In the case of Howie Ratner, it's pretty much basically this failed betting scheme that results in his death. In the case of I Care a Lot, it's the same exact scenario results in death. Both are eerily tragic, but never tone deaf, at least in my opinion. And the way how Blakeson handles this kind of juxtaposition between campy crime thriller and realist drama adds a level of adds a level of emotional vulnerability to the frame, but also adds also value to the meaning of what is being presented on screen. At least in my opinion.
Yeah, I think the comparison to Uncut Gems, it's not one I considered, but yeah, they definitely are, you know, kind of close cousins in terms of the ending. I do want to take it a step back and just kind of point out kind of how I was feeling when we get to the ending and the, you know, fake out resolution is that Marla Grayson, she's going to actually join forces with this Russian mafia. Because up until this point, this has been a movie about how a woman who has been cheating the system cheated the wrong person. And I think as it was getting through that point of it, I was like, you know, I don't know if this film has the, you know, maybe the most smartest or biting things or provocative things to say about what people, you know, go through when they are scam artists to this extent. You know, you get a little bit of Schadenfreude for sure in terms of like, you know, whenever something bad happens, you're kind of like, well, you know, they kind of deserve it. And you know, there's entertainment to be had in that. And it's almost like an amoral entertainment. But what I think gets this film to really land, at least for me, is when the first part of the resolution is, no, they actually can come together and cheat the system together. And this is sort of the foundation for a lot of the awful things that happen in our economy and in our system that takes place. I think it's a well-put montage toward the end where we see this woman becomes this CEO with like the best PR team in the world, considering, you know, it's certainly implausible that she would even get away with this until you think it's like, well, is it that implausible? Like this doesn't have to be based on a true story, I think, to resonate with people. And then I think that, you know, resounding ending, I've been a little conflicted on him. I was like, I've been wondering, is that realistic? Is she really going to pay consequences for this? And I think overall, I feel like yes, just because, you know, this is a scam that it would almost sort of like defy belief if nothing would have come to her, or it might've even been perceived as irresponsible for the ending to not even address what harm that she's done on people, which is where I think it definitely diverges from Nightcrawler and their sort of companion pieces in the way that they address. Sometimes people get away with it, sometimes they don't.
So I pretty much agree with all of what you guys are saying. I feel that this, without the ending, or at least without that fake out of an ending where the guy whose mother got taken away at the very beginning of the film comes back and actually does kill her in very, very similar in a way to Uncut Gems, where it's just out of nowhere, just a bullet to the head. So, and I feel that if that ending had been taken out, and we were left with kind of like that faux resolution that you were referring to, where it seems like if she's gotten everything she wants, I feel that maybe as John was saying, the critique that the film was trying to aim at wouldn't be so powerful or so deep, and it would be more of a comedic, like ending on a comedic note, which I'm not sure if it would have been the best to create as much of an impact as it intended. But I feel that with this ending that they included, where she ends up dying, and just that's pretty much where the film ends, that it does add some meaning to, okay, so what she did was wrong, and it does kind of bring that, okay, whatever happens, consequences will happen to you one way or another. And I feel that the way in which the consequences happened to her was maybe a little bit too unrealistic. I'd say, like, what are the odds that after you've gotten everything that you wanted, some random dude from your past is going to come and shoot you up? The way in which it happened was maybe a little bit too hard to believe. If we're going back to like how believable all of this is, I feel that in our society, probably there would be kind of like more broader consequences, or it wouldn't just be up in the hands of one guy. I think it kind of relates to kind of what's been going on with America, just in terms of how Trump has kind of been rising and rising and rising and rising, and now he's falling. But again, it's kind of in, I'd say, a similar way, where you just think that they're going to fail, they're going to fail, they're going to fail, and they're able to kind of evade every single drop and just bring more and more people on their sides. And you kind of have no idea how it's happening, but yet it happens somewhere or another. Trump's fall was not like quick. It took a while to orchestrate. And I feel that this, a sense of that, maybe even if it meant splitting the movie in two or just maybe adding an extra, maybe a couple of minutes to the film to kind of give it more scope, would have worked better and would have ended in a more realistic note. But I think at least what the ending was trying to get at, and it does achieve it, just I feel like it could have been even more impactful. But what it does achieve, I think, is a solid ending that definitely heightens my enjoyment and the value of the film.
I just have a quick thing. I'd say that my suspicion of like what Blakeson's trying to accomplish there is I don't think he's really framing her death around that sort of social commentary necessarily. I think he's trying to pay off this moment in the film with Peter Dinklage early on where she's claiming that she's not really afraid of death. And I think the ending is supposed to be this ambiguous, well, was she full of it? Or, you know, is that the case? And you kind of have to judge it by the performance of as she's dying there. And I think she is regretting what's happened because of her connection to Fran, played by Gonzalez. I think that it's sort of like that to me is a more potent, oh, like I am losing the person I love. You know, that ended up being my reason for wanting to be alive because it's clear that, you know, she didn't care about her family as they set up. And so I think that is, I think what Blakeson is going for. Now, whether or not it works and whether or not audiences are going to, you know, get that takeaway from it and consider it, you know, a substantial part of the film for them, that's a whole other thing. But that's kind of where I'm at with it currently.
Wait, quick question. Does anyone else have any thoughts or do you guys want to move on?
I just want to add that I'm very curious to see how audiences will respond to this movie. Because speaking of the comparisons to Nightcrawler and Uncut Gems, I think Nightcrawler got like a C cinema score and Uncut Gems was not met very favorably by mainstream audiences. I think it has a very low Rotten Tomatoes audience score. So I'm very curious to see how audiences will respond to this movie. And especially, you know, considering everything that happens in it. So that's going to be very interesting to watch.
So now we're going to delve right into Minari, which tells a story of a Korean-American family who moves to an Arkansas farm in search of their own American dream. So this one first premiered at Sundance, and since then it's become a hit. It's gone through multiple releases now. Again, it's shifted release dates, and yet it's still been able to maintain the buzz for both audiences and Oscar contention. So, John, what did you think about this one?
I loved Minari. It was my second favorite film of 2020, and I had the immense privilege of being able to see this in a theater for Sundance last year. And I'm so glad I did, just because it is the kind of film that, you know, is definitely, it's easier to feel transported by a film like this when you are in that sort of film atmosphere of, you know, the lights are down, it's a big enough screen. And it's a film that I've just been pondering and coming back to over the last year, particularly with the soundtrack from Emil Mosseri, which is just spellbinding. It's beautiful. And I rewatched the film just the other day as I was getting ready to interview Ye Jung-yoon, who plays the grandmother Soonja in this film. And so I've been kind of coming back to this film and kind of like thinking about it again and trying to figure out like, what is it about this movie that kind of separates it from some of the other Sundance films that maybe aren't as accessible in this. So, you know, the film is about this family in the 1980s who they're trying to achieve the American dream in rural Arkansas. They are Korean immigrants, and Steven Yeun is the patriarch, and he fights a lot with Yeri Han's character, who is the mother, and they have different ideas for what's best for their two young children, played by Alan Kim and Noel K. Cho. And I think what resonates with me the most about this movie is its universality, that people will be able to watch it. And I think people are responding to it because even if you're not from a Korean immigrant family, like Lee Isaac Chung, this is a semi-autobiographical film. And the director, Lee Isaac Chung, has stated that, you know, he's drawing from his own experiences in this. I think you can still watch this movie and really translate it into your own experiences. And that's what I did. You know, I'm not technically an immigrant just because my family's Puerto Rican. So they moved to the States. And so we didn't emigrate necessarily. We were born US citizens, but there is a very similar culture clash that I think is authentically captured here that I found very beautiful and simple. And, you know, I have, you know, a few minor quibbles, more things that have to do with like the discourse in this film surrounding like race relations and how we sort of like come together. I think this film sometimes dives into like, oh, I don't see color, like that kind of thing. But despite all of that, I think this is just a beautifully, wonderfully written, loving film that I just hope more and more people get to see, and I hope wins plenty of awards because I think it's very deserving.
So yeah, Minari was one of those films from last year where it really captivated me. It was a film that I kind of went in with not too many expectations. I knew that it won the Sundance Grand Jury Prize and the Audience Award at the Sundance Film Festival in 2020. But I sort of went in with high hopes, sort of, but also just to be a little bit cautious as I do with any other film that's usually getting a lot of hype. And for my money, I think it's actually one of A24's more poignant titles. It's a film that highlights the American dream and the tangibility of the American dream, just like I Care a Lot and all the previously mentioned films. However, it takes a completely different approach. It's more personal. It's more soft-spoken. It's more intimate. And it features a lot of provocative conversations on race relations and what it means to be a quote-unquote American. I think the church scene in the film, if you know what I'm talking about, you know it, is simultaneously cringeworthy and insightful. It offers a lot of insight on at least the American perspective from a white community and the Asian community in America. And at least in my opinion, it really works, especially from somebody who comes from an immigrant background, with my parents immigrating to Canada in the 1990s from Colombia.
John, I have to say, I'm so incredibly jealous of you getting to see this in a movie theater, because hands down, this is an award season movie for me. I adored it so much. As someone who comes from an immigrant background, I was just really able to connect to it. And I just loved everything about it. The performances, the direction, the score, everything was just completely perfect for me. And Steven Yeun, his performance is so great. It's understated. It's not flashy, which makes me worried for his Oscar nomination prospects. But there's a lot of nuance to it. You know, just these simple looks that he gives, or these gestures that really say so much. Not everyone can pull off a performance like this, but he really knocks it out of the park. Just an incredibly phenomenal talent. And Yoonhee Jung is getting, you know, raves for her performance, which she absolutely deserves. She was just amazing. But I also think Han Yi-ri, who plays Monica, the main character's wife, I think she's just so good in this too. And I wish she was getting a bit more love this award season as well.
Yeah, so I watched this one actually back in the Hamptons International Film Festival. Like I was not able to catch it in theaters. So again, also same here, John, that you're incredibly lucky for getting that opportunity. Well, that was back in Sundance, back when the pandemic hadn't even happened. But I think I may have enjoyed it a tad bit more if I had seen it in theaters. But this one, while it did definitely work for me, and I feel like maybe it was just a little bit too soft. And like, I feel like it could have definitely tackled on those themes maybe like in a more in-depth kind of way to truly make an impact on me. However, I know this is going to bring some controversy to this discussion. But overall, though, I would say it's definitely a win for me. I absolutely like loved the fact that it was even trying to tackle these themes. I feel that in this awards season, when that's like delved so much into big spectacle, or even with Nomadland still a large scope, that this is still able to remain kind of an intimate study of this family and of the immigrant experience in America. And again, my family, well, half of my family, my mom's side, also came from Puerto Rico, and then my dad's side also came from Mexico. So I have a little bit of that experience in me as well. And there were some scenes where it felt a little bit awkward, but there were some other scenes that just were pretty powerful, I'd say, especially, again, I wouldn't say this is a big spoiler, and we're gonna delve into this later, but one of the penultimate scenes where kind of their whole like kind of crop is just burning and their home is burning because of the grandmother, but it was an accident, but like it was still because of someone and it wasn't just out of a coincidence. That scene, I think, was very powerful and really hit me hard, because it was just seeing all their work, or not all their work, but a good majority of their work kind of just crumbling down in front of them. And that power is some that I really enjoyed. And unfortunately, I feel that that power of that scene didn't fully carry over to the rest of the film. So that's why maybe I don't like it as much as everyone else does, but I still think it's a very, very solid flick. The fact that he even tries to tackle these issues and it does so in a solid way, I feel that's something that needs to be commended.
I would just like to say, Diego, that I agree. I know it's a bit of a hot take, but I do very much agree what you said. I think my issue with Minari is primarily that it's a little bit rushed. A lot of events go by quick, like by the whim. And I guess that is sort of the point. It's sort of like nostalgia, remembering your childhood. All of these memories come clashing down into a feature form. But at the same time, I wish there was a little bit more breathing room, a little more quiet, a little bit more timid, instead of sort of like that soft-spoken approach that's featured throughout the whole entire film. Something a little bit more social realist, at least in my opinion. Because there's a lot of great moments, as you said, like the house burning scene, but a lot of it doesn't come with the impact that it truly deserves, at least in my opinion. And in that regard, I do think Lee Isaac Chung is a very talented director. He knows a lot about atmosphere. He knows a lot about execution of his environments. He has a great sense of spatial geography. And with all those technical elements, I just sort of wish there was a little bit more time to focus on it. Maybe an extra, let's say, 20 minutes or so. Make it a little bit like a 2-hour and 15-minute feature. And you've got something a little bit more personal, a little bit more intimate, and a little bit more speculative into the life of this Korean-American family.
Yeah, to bounce off what David, you just said, and Diego as well, and I don't know, Ahmad, where you stand, I definitely think it's a good thing when, you know, the thing you might not like about the movie is that you want more from it, for sure. Even if it's coming from like different motivations. Like I think for me, I want more of it, not because I think that it was lacking or that it didn't have enough breathing room, but just in my opinion, I think that more would have, you know, strengthened the film and helped it. And I totally understand though what you both are saying about the softness. I think the reason it worked for me, and you know, even though it might not have worked as well for everybody else to some degree, I think is because I really was comfortable with how this film told the story from the perspective of the two children, particularly David. I think it does make sense that it's like a patchwork of memories, as has been stated, and it does kind of like go by like with a very vague passage of time. And I think if it had been that by itself, I would have had issues with it because I would have felt like it was too much of a mosaic, that it didn't have like this narrative through line. But I think the reason for me was successful, and I think we can agree partly on this for sure, is the grandmother character. I think her insertion into the story, she's this foul-mouthed, puckish, you know, anti-American media grandmother who comes in and shakes up the story and adds, I think, that sort of catalyst to the memories that sort of defines David's personality, that he starts to really become, you know, more of an agent in his own life through his relationship with this grandmother character, his growth through his relationship with her, and particularly how she is able to kind of teach him how to, I think, like experience a life that isn't totally a mirror of what his parents want for him. I think that the American dream is something that his dad wants, his mother wants. They disagree on what it looks like. I think the grandmother doesn't really have an American dream. In fact, when I was talking to Yeo Jung Yoon about this, she even said that. She was like, this is a character who comes to this country and she doesn't have this sort of dream. She just wants to help her family. And I think what Chung does successfully in this movie is he shows that David is learning that, you know, you don't have to have an American dream just to help people and to love people and to avoid discrimination, that you can really just sort of like live a life that good things can happen, can come about. Not to give away the ending, but I think the last shot of this film perfectly illustrates that with, you know, after the fire and what happens with the title of the film, the Minari itself. I think it's a great metaphor. And it really hit me. I really found myself very emotional, especially the second time, because I caught some things that I had missed before. And, you know, I was able to be like, oh, you know, I think this is what Chung is going for. And I think that it's fantastic he was able to make this movie and that it's as heartfelt as it is for me.
Yeah, I definitely agree with everything you said, John. But I think it would have been really interesting as well to see Anne's perspective. Anne is David's sister in the movie, and it would have been interesting to see more of her perspective and more of her point of view, because she's essentially a blank slate throughout the movie. We don't really get to know her as a character, as opposed to the rest of the family. So I think I definitely would have loved to see more of her character and more of her experience, because it as much as it was strange for David, it was equally, if not more, strange for Anne. So it would have been nice to get a second perspective on these experiences. But I do understand that at the end of the day, it's David's story. And to me, I do think the movie was pretty well paced, especially compared to some of the more slower award season movies. But I do understand where people come from, because it would have been nice to see more of the family bonding together and just, sharing their experiences while they're, trying to acclimate in this new country. So yeah, I definitely see where everyone's coming from. But I do think it was a great movie overall for me.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you about Anne. I think that is probably my biggest criticism of the film, is that I understand what he's going for with her character, that she's like the firstborn child who kind of gets overlooked. Like, I think that's the point of her character, right? Is that she is, the unsung hero of this family. She looks after her little brother. She's well behaved, but she doesn't get any attention. And I think it's a mistake for Chung to sort of translate that to the filmmaking. It's like, give her some attention. I think that it would have added a lot to this film, and it's a huge missed opportunity. And despite such a great performance, and I think he doesn't do that with Monica, because I think that I agree that like she's very deserving of awards attention, because she could have so easily have been portrayed as like this nagging, annoying, matriarch, this like terrible version of a mother that I don't think would have been nearly as authentic. And instead, she's the conscientious objector. She's a multidimensional character. And I really wish Anne could have been as well. I wish there had been more with her, because I think it would have been really effective.
Yeah. So again, some of the points that you guys touched on, I definitely agree. For sure, I think that Anne's role could have definitely been expanded on a bit more. And who knows, maybe through that expansion, that would have maybe kind of given us a different look into the family's bond and kind of given us what me and David were kind of hoping for a bit more. Because again, I feel that this was a very light and breezy film. Because again, it touches on all these themes, right? Like, it definitely explores them to a certain extent. But I feel that there are very few moments where it actually goes fully in depth. And instead of maybe just wading in the pool, it doesn't really go into the deep end until kind of those final scenes. And I would have liked a little bit of more of that. And one of those things, I think, would be the family's bond, but potentially also their interactions with other people. Because again, most of the interactions they have are positive. And maybe this movie is trying to be very optimistic, but I feel that maybe it resulted in it being a little bit too idealistic and too optimistic in its message, and that it could have benefited from potentially having a little bit more of the negativity that comes with the immigrant experience, because I feel that is an angle that deserves to be explored. And that I feel that if you're going to create a fully complete portrait of the immigrant experience, I feel that you need to look into the negatives and the positives as well, and not just focus on one or the other. Although, again, I think one of the reasons that this film has been so successful this award season, that it even though it's an indie film, it has been picking up some steam, and it's toe-to-toe with some of the biggest contenders, is because of its optimistic attitude that is not bound as much in the other films this award season. I think that's why a lot of voters are liking it. But personally, for me, I would have appreciated a little bit more of a multidimensional, again, positives, but also the negatives as well. But again, I totally understand why they chose to go that route. It's just that maybe it didn't work as well for me.
You mentioned about how the final scenes were a lot more impactful, at least thematically, and even in terms of the commentary on the American dream. And I do agree with that. And I think my main issue, my most prominent issue with the film, is more so with the ending. I love the idea of the ending. I even love the way how Isaac kind of just maneuvers the camera into like the stream, and then we see the Minari plant grow, and it's beautiful. It's almost sensual like. But I think my issue is the placement of that scene. I think there should have been more prior to that moment, where there should have been a little bit more detail about like the family recovery, because at the end of the day, while I do think that individually that scene is perfect, the ending of the film, I do think it is very abrupt. It ends on almost a very inconclusive note, which is kind of ironic because it is basically the perfect ending, quote unquote. And yet it's sort of like this situation where in theory it should work, but in execution, not so much. So I just wish that Lee Isaac Chung did a little bit more in terms of the material there for the finale.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I definitely didn't have that same thought. And I'm trying to, you know, definitely see where you're coming from. I guess for me, I think that it is conclusive, you know, just not with plot, but I think with its story. I think, yeah, in a plot sense, it's not conclusive in the sense of like, well, does the farm work out? Does that, you know, what happens with the family? I guess my takeaway was just, it didn't really matter. And I think the point is Yun's character learning that he doesn't have to put all of his hopes and dreams into this farm, that this Minari plant can, you know, be an alternate avenue. And there's multiple paths for this family. I think up until this point, he has definitely been, you know, on this railroad of like, there's only one thing I can do. There's only one thing that's going to make this family happy and is going to secure our future. And I think when all of that burns down and he finds that, no, this has been growing in the background, I just needed to open my mind to it, I think that's conclusive to that part of the story. And that's why I guess I didn't have that similar, you know, disappointment, I suppose. And I'd also say like, I totally get the optimism thing. I think that the reason it didn't bother me as much was just because it did feel kind of tense because I was waiting for it to happen a lot. You know, I was waiting for like somebody to do something super racist and like harmful, and you know, for them to. I guess what Chung was trying to do, and you know, rightfully or not, you know, that's certainly up for debate, is just like trying to say like, this family doesn't need that to be an extra obstacle, you know, if it isn't, and that there are so many other forces working against them, that the sort of casual racism is there. And it's certainly like, I think what it's doing to them is a slower, quieter thing. It's like a casual isolation form of racism where, you know, they're not getting the full support of the community. There's only like a few people who are really like making an effort to connect with them. I think the film could have done more to illustrate that for sure, because I think that it's he's definitely not overt enough about it where I think everyone's going to see that as like certainly a valid reading of this film. So that's definitely where I would draw the line.
I just wanted to touch on what everyone was saying about how what Diego and David were saying about the positive experiences that they were having in this country. I do want to just reiterate that this is semi-autobiographical from Lee Isaac Chung, and so maybe he did not have more negative experiences growing up. But another thing I wanted to add is that we tend to look at our childhoods through rose-colored glasses. So this could also be the case here, where he's trying to paint this sort of perfect, you know, utopia version of his childhood, where not a lot of negativity or not a lot of bad experiences, you know, were being he or his family went through during his childhood. So I just wanted to just reiterate that this is semi-autobiographical, so it is based on his actual experiences.
That is true, and I mean, you do bring up a good point in terms of that maybe he's looking at it through the childlike optimism rather than kind of maybe like a grounded like present day study of maybe the immigrant experience. And again, I think that if that's what the film is trying to achieve, it does it well. It's just that I think for me, maybe it didn't resonate as much because of that, because I do like those films that kind of just do give the fuller picture and maybe just don't focus on one side like that, or maybe with a little bit less bias in terms of optimism. But again, I feel it has shown to work for a lot of people. It's getting a lot of critical praise and a lot of awards attention. So obviously it seems that that strategy is working out well. So.
The racism in this film isn't really framed as like a persistent thing. And I think the reason for that is because David doesn't notice it, because kids don't notice that sort of thing. And I think every childhood experience is different, but I guess it resonated with me because that does match kind of like, you know, I'm someone who I can be white passing. So like I certainly didn't experience nearly as much prejudice and racism as, for example, like my sister. My sister is definitely not white passing. So like our experiences are very different. But, you know, the casual racism that I always experienced like growing up, I didn't really know it. Like I didn't know it was discrimination until I got a little bit older. And I think, you know, good or bad, I think Chung just, I probably felt like if he framed the scenes in a different way, or if he sort of like made it a bit harsher, or have had more of an edge to capture like just how messed up it is that this, you know, this kid is saying something so messed up to this other kid, then I think that it might have felt a little jarring. It might have felt a little out of place just because, you know, David doesn't notice it. And it probably wouldn't have made sense if he had noticed it, because how would he? And so I think that it's the sort of thing that like people can absolutely disagree on and people can like dissect. And I think that in and of itself is a great thing, just because I don't think we get enough stories about the way children take in racism. And I like that this is like an alternate, you know, version that allows us to like pay attention to, you know, the joys of this family, the downfalls of this family, without relying on racism as a plot device. That's just something that I really appreciate about this. And, you know, certainly could be better. I think we could all agree on that. But I definitely am pretty happy with how this is turning out. And I'd love to talk about awards, because I think that, you know, I was nervous this wouldn't really get much buzz because people would forget it. But I'm glad to see, for example, Yeo Jung-yoon is getting, you know, nominated for a SAG award, first Korean actress ever to be awarded for the best supporting. And so I'm pretty thrilled about that in particular.
Yeah, so I guess let's just take it from there and delve right in. I mean, John has already kind of voiced his opinions on that. Personally, while I would love if Steven Yeun and the actress for the grandmother, and honestly, pretty much the entire ensemble got some sort of recognition, which it has a SAG ensemble. And I do think that it's going to get in for picture for sure. I'm not as confident in terms of the acting categories and Lee Isaac Chung's direction in terms of that they'll get in. I think that they are worthy of it, but I think what they're doing is a little too subtle for what the Academy normally goes for, especially in the direction, maybe the technical categories. I feel it is a little too subdued for the Academy's tastes, but hopefully, I hope that it can get in, because again, it's gotten some attention from the guilds already. Even with the Golden Globes controversial introduction of the having it be into the foreign language category, which again, that is up. I think it's definitely controversial, but at least with that, it got a nomination, and it would have gone home empty-handed at the Golden Globes if it wasn't for that sole nomination. But overall, I do like that it's being recognized. And again, I thought that it was going to get totally potentially ignored by awards groups. But I think it was also partially the fact that so many potential contenders moved into the next year. It kind of did open up the game to a lot of those indie kind of films that may have not gotten as much attention.
I'm incredibly nervous that Steven Yeun might not get an Oscar nomination, because he was snubbed at the Golden Globes. And just to reiterate, I think it's a very subtle performance. It's not as flashy as some of the other performances in the category. So I'm still very nervous about that. But I would love to see him get a nomination. And Yoon Jung, of course, who does a phenomenal job in this movie. I'm not too sure about its prospects for director and screenplay. I do think it might get a Best Picture nomination, but I don't really see it getting a director one. Yeah, and score as well. I think it has a really gorgeous score, and I think it really could land a score nomination as well.
One thing I'd like to mention is the fact that Rain Song, the song that plays in the film, was recently shortlisted for Best Original Song at the Oscars. And I really hope that, because out of all the shortlisted songs, I think Rain Song is easily the most beautiful, swooning, and majestic, I guess, if that's the right word, out of the batch of shortlisted songs. And it would be awesome if Rain Song makes it into the final cut. I honestly don't think it's going to happen, which makes me honestly really sad because the Academy really likes those flashy music-based songs with lyrics that like are so passionate and empowering and that sort of deal. Case in point, last year when Wild Rose got snubbed and a bunch of other films were replaced over for that category. But Minari, maybe in this sort of slow year of Oscar contention, it could get in for Best Original Song. I think it would be an incredible feat if it did get eventually nominated. And as everybody already stated, I honestly don't think it's going to get nominated in the acting categories, which I do think is a little bit disappointing to say the least, because Steven Yeun does a terrific job, and Yoo Jung, who played Soon-jet, the grandmother, also portrayed a very relatable but also humanistic portrayal.
Yeah, I guess I have a slightly different take. I definitely agree that score and original song are certainly, like, you know, I'll be really happy if it gets nominations for that in the Academy. And I think it's certainly, you know, if not likely, it's certainly plausible. I could definitely see it happening. I think Steven Yeun is a bit of a long shot, unfortunately. I think it's a really stacked category this year. I think, you know, the Academy is probably just going to opt for Gary Oldman and Anthony Hopkins. This is Chadwick's year to lose. Riz Ahmed. I mean, it's just, there are so many actors, you know, coming at each other for this. But I do think that Yoo Jung-yoon does stand a really good shot of getting nominated and could potentially be an upset win, only because I think that the other people on the shortlist aren't nearly as strong. I think Minari has been getting momentum through the SAG nomination for Yoo Jung-yoon. It would be a historical win for her, which the Academy definitely likes to opt for. And the competition's not super great. I mean, I think that, you know, I don't think Glenn Close is going to get it. I think Maria Bakalova isn't somebody who stands a strong chance. I know some people are saying that Hillbilly Elegy is going to be an upset, and certainly we can't discount anything. But I think the main competition is Olivia Colman. And I guess the reason I have hope is that the Academy doesn't love awarding people so soon after they win. It happens for sure. But I do think that, you know, as a supporting character, Olivia Colman's performance in The Father, which I have not seen yet, so I don't know if it's, you know, if it deserves to win. I do think that I do think there is a decent chance. And so that's what I'm hoping for. And my other long shot, I'd say, is Best Picture nomination. I do think it is possible based on how well it's been doing with critic societies. But, you know, who knows, because the Academy lets us down all the time.
Yeah, honestly, right now at least in my top 10, I don't know if it's going to be either 8 or 9. And honestly, in the year like this, I could see it happening with 10 nominees, but that's a very long shot. I think it definitely, right now, I think its best chance at a nomination is most likely, at least in above the line categories, is definitely Picture. It has picked up steam there, specifically with that SAG Ensemble nom. Definitely show that there's industry support. Again, the director, I don't know. The acting category is a little bit risky, but in supporting actors, I do have to mention, well, people were kind of denying this or in denial about this, and I think a lot of people still are, but Glenn Close, I'd say, is nearly a lock to win. I really hope she doesn't, but it's a showy performance. It's basically, if we're talking about awards narratives, I think she definitely has the strongest narrative in the category, in that she's been nominated 7 times and still hasn't won. And the Academy loves awarding and nominating people who haven't won an award yet. So I definitely think that she is pretty much poised to win that category right now. Although I do agree that apart from that disagreement that we have with that, I definitely think Olivia Colman is a little bit shaky. Amanda Seyfried is a little bit shaky. Ellen Burstyn, who was a front runner for a while, is dropping off. I still have her in personally, but I'm not sure. And again, I feel that they're going to pull another Kathy Bates here and pick Jodie Foster as a supporting actress 5th slot, because they do really love honoring those like industry legends and kind of those like supporting actor, actress slots when there maybe is a couple that are still in contention. And unfortunately, right now, I do have her out of the lineup. I really hope she or Bakalova do surprise. Again, like in my heart, I really hope that they are able to surprise. But in the moment right now, I may be a little bit too unoptimistic. Like, I'm definitely on the pessimistic side of things. And people are more optimistic about the Oscars than me, it seems. But right now, that's where I'm looking at it at the moment.
I think it will come down to marketing, just because, you know, I mean, look at the difference of like how much time they've had. Like, I think Minari has had over a year to really ramp up like being seen by a lot of Academy members. And I think that also, like, it's now just getting its on-demand release. So I think it really depends on like how much money A24 puts into this over the next month, because they do have the momentum compared to Hillbilly Elegy, which, man, that had no impact. Like, you know, it, or at least not an impact like you would expect. Like, I don't think this is, I think this will kind of be a similar situation to The Wife, where it's a film that just sort of came and went. And it's even worse than The Wife in that sense, because it was, you know, trashed by critics. People really didn't respond to it. And I guess that's why I'm probably feeling a little bit more optimistic. But again, you just never know. And I think that Glenn Close for sure never won an award, but yet neither has Yeah Jung-yoon. And I think that the Academy might be looking at, like, I mean, she's been making movies for over 55 years. And I would hope that a lot of people in the Academy who are voting are aware of her work. It's just, you know, sadly, that's probably not the case.
Yeah, and also something that I did forget to mention is, you guys can correct me on this, but I believe all of her performance, if not the majority of it, is done in Korean, which that's also something that unfortunately the Academy still hasn't been able to kind of get over. Like, even with the whole Parasite win last year, they didn't nominate a single Korean actor, which was a little bit of a travesty. And I'm not quite sure if the Academy is self-aware enough to make sure to not repeat that same mistake. I hope, again, this is more about, like, I hope they don't, and I hope she gets nominated, but at the moment, it seems a little bit too out of reach for me. Although, again, hopefully she gets that backing from the guilds. Hopefully the guilds just back the film all the way around, just like the SAG Ensemble nomination did. But I think we're going to have to see. Again, this is pretty much one of the most tumultuous seasons in recent memory, for sure. And it seems now like every day there's new front runners, people's chances going up and down like crazy, much more than it has in years past. Well, that's it for this week's episode of the Global Film Podcast. Where can we find everyone on social media? John?
You can find me on Twitter at John Negroni, or you can find me on Letterboxd for all of my latest movie stuff. And that's also John Negroni.
David?
You can find me on Twitter at TICKTOCKANIMATE, TikTok Animate. Same applies with Instagram and Letterboxd.
Ahmad?
You can find me on at Written by Ahmad on Twitter. That's AHMAD. Or on at The Film Updates, also on Twitter.
And you can find me at The Diego Andaluz, and that's ANDALUZ, as well as at Global Film Pod on Twitter and Letterboxd. Thank you, everyone, for coming on board, and make sure to rate, subscribe, and follow us to be notified when the next episode comes out. Thank you all for listening, and have a great rest of your week.